Okay, my first announcement is about donations, because I haven't said it a whole lot. We talked a fair amount during the annual appeal when we focus on awareness that we rely on donations and a lot of volunteer efforts. At that time, many people became sustainers or renewed their sustainer pledge, and that helps a lot. In addition to that, we do rely on donations giving during class and with visiting teachers, sponsorships, and things like that. So I'm kind of giving you the practical side of that. I think a lot of our teachers would say the more important thing is developing your generosity. So listen to the people who have more wise things to say about that. If you have any questions about how we take donations or anything like that, I'd be happy to help you out. The next module is Spiritual Teacher. It is not until July 10th. So the next one is July 10th, 17th, and 24th. That's it. Just 3 weeks until September 25th. So we have a fairly good break after this. Dawn's going to do it in 3 weeks. and then we're going to have a bunch of Light of the Past stuff going on. And then after that, Robbie's going to come back for our Death and Rebirth. we all come back for Death and Rebirth, as Donna said. Yes, that is true. I guess, you know, since Shanti, you've taught it a lot, I just want to say that, you know, this class is, this spiritual teacher class is not, okay, I've been thinking about this for 10 years, tell me the steps I need to take to have a spiritual teacher. It's a foundation of the concept, how it relates to your path, how this will benefit your mind. You'll get lots of things out of it, even if it's something that might be far into the future for you. So I just want to encourage people to come, even if it seems like something far away. Yes, okay, my other encouraging piece of advice is a lot of us did, Don Brown's teaching the next class, a lot of us did Presenting the Path with him, and a lot of people did all the work except you're still memorizing that Lam Rim prayer. So now you have from like now until July 10th when we see Don again, we could just spend all that time on our Lam Rim prayers, and then we'd be able to complete those completion cards. So that's my cheerleader kind of motivation for between now and then. If you're completing this module, like for the, you know, finishing the all the work for this module, there's a completion card at the back and that test that was given last week. I handed it out last week. So finish that at some point. It's less of a test and more of like an essay answer kind of thing. So you if you didn't get the handout last week, it's at the back of the class. So there's two things to turn in to complete this module, the answers to those questions and the completion card that's about your meditations and your readings and things like that. Any questions? Yes. If you're not ready to take credit for the module, meaning like maybe you still have some meditations or some reading or something to do, do you need to turn in the test? I would keep them together when they're both complete. Give them to me. I'll scan them, put them online, and I will email Shanka, and we'll get it settled. Okay. Next up is Donna, our spiritual program coordinator.
Hi, guys. This past weekend was really a great one for reminding us about interdependent arising. You know, Friday was Sagadawa, which is where we kind of reach all the way back to the Buddha's lifetime and celebrate the fact that he was here, he got enlightened, and he passed on and shared all of this with us. And we wouldn't be here if he hadn't come along and done that 2,500 years ago. And then, of course, on Saturday, we were celebrating the fact that Kanapa Center has been here. And once again, we wouldn't be here if Kanapa Center wasn't here and if we hadn't had so many people come through and contribute in one way or another. And so, of course, we want to pay that forward in every way we can and create the cause, not only in this lifetime, but in all our lifetimes, to meet the teachings. And one way we do that at Kadampa Center is by appreciating our teachers with just a little offering of thanks. So here's for Shanka.
So, I guess, is it on now? It's on in my thing. Okay. So, speaking of, death and rebirth, right? So I thought a few years ago there was some Tom Cruise movie. I don't remember the name of the movie. My son saw it on Netflix or Amazon or something like that, and he showed it to me again. But I was passing this movie theater and it had a big poster, but Tom Cruise and some really beautiful-looking woman, they're both holding machine guns, and, you know, they're coming out of some fiery inferno or something like that, you know. And it says, live, die, repeat, you know. And I thought, you know, Hollywood has discovered Buddhism, you know. So, anyway. The other thing I wanted to mention, totally unrelated, is I don't know if you know, there's a radio show called Invisibilia on NPR. It's basically about, I haven't listened to it very much, but I think it's mainly how our minds work, but psychology and emotions and so forth and so on, right? And so, you should, I encourage you to go to you can go to the Invisibilia podcast website, right? Just type in Invisibilia, NPR, and it'll come up. They had an incredible, incredible show 2 weeks ago. It's on the podcast, online, you can listen to it. About how we have emotions and how we perceive our world around us is totally wrong. Okay? So there's a psychologist at Harvard or somewhere where she's doing this research, and it's coming out now. And she wrote this book. And it's totally, in fact, she wrote the book because she heard on Invisibilia about this topic, and she said, no, that's totally wrong, so I'm going to write this book. And basically, it talks about, this had nothing to do with today's class, but still, it talks about how, you know, we think that we see things, then, you know, and then emotions arise, right? But in fact, what she's saying is actually how we perceive is that, you know, we, with our eyes, let's say, and if I'm looking at something, my eyes just see blue and red, things like that, right? And then it gets relayed to the brain where it has a memory, it has a concept, it's created a concept from past experience as to what this thing that looks blue and red and rectangular, whatever it is, most likely is. Using the concept, it does a match. And then it says, that's what I'm seeing. So if you're seeing a carpet, I see the blue and the red, a rectangular thing. It looks around and it says, in the past I've seen a carpet, you know, they're usually on the ground and, you know, the rectangular, blah, blah, blah. It does a match and it says, this is what a carpet is. This is a carpet, right? And then emotions arise from it, right? I like it, I don't like it, or if it's a person, I hate that person just because he appears in front of me, right? You know, like sometimes you say, you know, just seeing, you know, he just looks like he's a whatever, you know, so-and-so, right? I mean, we don't even know him. It's because we have some conceptual framework already built in and we just match it, right? So, and this is exactly what Buddhism says in Buddhist epistemology. Right, if you study the mind and mental, anyway, mind and its function, you know, those texts. That's exactly what they've been saying, and this is why what they talk about reality, how the Buddha said, we perceive things is actually exactly opposite of how reality really is. Right, so you should listen to that show. It's actually a great introduction into the Buddhist, because in Buddhism, you know, they talk about how you have the eye consciousness, right, which perceives things, but it doesn't label it, doesn't do any judgment, just sees. So the eye consciousness is different from the eye organ, right? So the eye consciousness uses the eye organ, and it sees, perceives blue and the red and so forth and so on, right? And then in our minds, because of karmic imprints and various other reasons, we have what's called a generic image that we have created. Like, you know, you may not have ever seen the Space Needle in Seattle, right? You may not have seen it, you know, in person, right? But if somebody puts a picture of the Space Needle in front of you, you will know that's a Space Needle from Seattle. How? Because you have created that generic image of a Space Needle and you're matching it to it, right? So that's what Buddhism says. You take that concept, you match it. I mean, take that, what you perceive, and you match it, right? And then once you match it, that goes, then your mental consciousness kicks in and it says, oh, I hate it, I love it, whatever it is. Right? All that stuff then arises, right? It's exactly the same. It was fascinating. Anyway, so I encourage you to go check it out. Yeah. Oh.
That sounds like something similar. In art, there's a great book, Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain.
Yeah.
It's taking away the analytical part, because if you sit down to draw an apple, your mind automatically perceives what you see as an apple. And if you go to draw it, it kind of looks like, you know, you're a childlike level of drawing, where the great artists can turn that off and just draw exactly what they see or paint or anything like that. So they're taking kind of the mind away and just using their senses.
Yeah, so anyway, so I don't want to spend too much time on it because that's not really relevant, but I encourage you to go check it out because it's quite revealing, I guess, fascinating. Okay, so let's start with a short breathing meditation, you know, just to calm our minds, and then we'll do a refuge meditation using Shakyamuni Buddha as done by Lama Zopa. So I'm going to use his words as we do the meditation. Right? So... remember how to keep your posture and you can do the 9-round breathing if you need to calm yourself down or 3 deep breaths as Dalai Lama says. So let's begin with the correct motivation, an altruistic motivation that we hope to, our goal is to bring joy and love and compassion to, first of all, ourselves. Because without that, we can't be a benefit to others. So we need to practice that with ourselves.
And then, of course, the Bodhisattva motivation of our practice only for the benefit of others. At the level of my forehead, about 2 meters in front of me, is Shakyamuni Buddha. Each feature of his holy body represents an aspect of his omniscient mind, and so forth. His inner attainments, each feature also demonstrates the causes, that is, the merit that was collected in the past. No matter how much one looks at Shakyamuni Buddha, one never feels satiated. The supreme refuge, Shakyamuni Buddha, encompasses the Guru, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So here you can, if you remember, you can think about why they are objects of refuge, why they are worthy of being objects of refuge. You can think about the analogy of the doctor and the medicine, and the patient and the nurse. From his holy body, beams are emitted in all 10 directions. Numberless manifestations of the Buddha are carried on each beam to ripen infinite sentient beings. Looking at me with compassionate eyes, the Buddha says, son or daughter of the lineage, if you want to be liberated from the suffering of samsara, I will guide you. He happily promises this and frees me from the breathless state. So now that we have created the visualization of the Buddha, we do the refuge meditation. Around me are seated infinite father and mother sentient beings. They are completely intoxicated with the unimaginable, infinite sufferings of each of the 6 realms. They are wide-eyed, desperately looking for refuge, pitifully calling, even screaming. So all the beings in the hell realms, the animal realms, the preta realms, the hungry ghost realm, the god realm, so can imagine their suffering and how they wish they could get out. Continuously circling in samsara's 6 realms, I have been tormented by suffering during beginningless rebirths until now. I have still not found the opportunity to be liberated from this. Fortunately, this time I have received a perfect human body. Because of my good fortune, I have met the most sublime teaching, the Buddha Dharma, and the founder, Shakyamuni Buddha. So that's truly amazing, because as we've discussed before, the Buddhas come very, very rarely. There are many, 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 many eons where there's no Dharma, there's no Buddha, called the dark eons. The fact that we are at the time of a historical Buddha, we are incredibly blessed. I have no certainty that I will not die today. My death could happen even today. If I should die today, I would have no freedom to choose the realm in which I would reincarnate. I could fall down the precipice into one of the realms of the evil migratory beings. That is the hell realms or the hungry ghost realm. I should think carefully about whether I would be able to bear those sufferings for even 1 second. So think about your current, state, that is, or state of suffering, or what you have to go through in your current life, and what it would be like in one of the lower realms. And you can kind of put it into perspective. Although it is extremely unlikely, if I were to achieve the body of a deva or a human, I would still be ceaselessly tormented by many hundreds of sufferings, such as rebirth, old age, sickness and death, dissatisfaction, anxiety, lack of fulfillment, relationship problems, and so forth. And after that, I would again fall down into the lower realms. There is nothing to trust about being in the upper realms. That is, whether you're born as a human being or in one of the God realms, you're just still have the same, you're still within cyclic existence. Thus, during this one time that I have obtained a perfect human body with freedoms and richnesses, I have been guided by the sublime virtuous friend who reveals the path. And I have the wisdom to discriminate between the shortcomings of samsara and the benefits of liberation. Therefore, I should quickly achieve liberation from this terrifying samsara. So I think it's important here to think about, we discussed how we, the three kinds of sufferings and the all-pervasive suffering, how we're not even aware that we are actually in the middle of suffering. So the Buddha, we have this perfect human rebirth where we have the mental faculties, the leisure, the time, we have the Dharma that's available, and we are told how the suffering is, so we are told how we suffer. So, and the sublime virtuous friend, the Buddha, our gurus, they've spent or are spending their lives in trying to get us to that liberation. Because they've traveled the path, they know the pitfalls, they know the right road to take. So we should examine, and we should be willing to put our faith or our refuge in them. Just like we put our faith in the doctor and we take his medicine. When we're sick. But the Buddha talked about, everything else that we do, it is only for this life. that the Buddha gave the medicine, the Dharma, for all, to liberate us from, the deepest level of suffering. So we can cut the cycle of samsara at its root. So there is no greater endeavor than that. So everything else pales in comparison. All the things that we do, all the great the pride we take in all the things, all the achievements that we have, pales in comparison to making that effort to reach liberation and get out of this cycle. That's why only the Buddha, only the Gurus, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, His Holiness Dalai Lama, these are the beings who are showing us the path. So you can think about how they are worthy of refuge. Yet to liberate only myself from samsara is not at all sufficient. This is not the meaning of my life. Numberless sentient beings, equal in the limitless sky, are wandering in the suffering states of samsara. They have all been my fathers and mothers. That if we've had infinite lives, from beginningless time, then all the beings at some point or other must have been our fathers and mothers and sons and daughters and dear friends and so forth. So there's no reason why we should hold fathers and mothers in this life with any greater love than our next door neighbor, who surely was one of them at some point. Just because we don't remember them does not mean that they're not worthy of our love. Because that's how the enlightened beings see other beings. With the same, they say that the Buddha, the love that he has for his spouse or for his child, is the exact same love he has for all other beings. Or like the mother has for a child, really, actually. So the Buddha's love for beings is like the mother's love for her child. So because of all these mothers and fathers around us, I must liberate them and lead them to the peerless happiness of full enlightenment. Who is the refuge and guide who liberates from the great oceans of beginningless samsara? There is no other accept the three sublime ones, the Buddha, the teachings, and the spiritual community, the Sangha. Therefore, together, I and each and every migratory being equaling the sky go for refuge to the three jewels, the founder, the fully enlightened one, the Dharma, the scriptural understanding and realizations, and the Sangha, the transcendental assembly. So we can say three times to the Guru, basically to the Guru I go for refuge, to the Buddha I go for refuge, to the Dharma I go for refuge, to the Sangha I go for refuge. To the Dharma I go for refuge, to the Sangha I go for refuge, to the Guru I go for refuge, to the Buddha I go for refuge, to the Dharma I go for refuge, to the Sangha I go for refuge, to the Guru I go for refuge, to the Buddha I go for refuge, to the Dharma I go for refuge, to the Sangha I go for refuge. Each refuge recitation pleases the refuge object, Shakyamuni Buddha. So to end the meditation, actually, let's sit for a moment and imagine that the Buddha has this wonderful smile on his face. He's looking at us with his eyes of great compassion. You know, he is really happy that we are making the effort. You know, that we have become, as they say, you know, the child of the conqueror. You know, so the Buddha sees us as his son or his daughter. So he's happy like that, happy like a father is when the son or daughter pleases him. So it's really important in these meditations, when you do these visualizations, to really make it as real as possible, that you actually feel, you know, you see the smile, you feel the, you know, the love from his eyes, and
Okay. All right. So, you know, so you'll see that in these, you know, there's a standard way, you know, where you do the visualization, you imagine the deity or the Buddha or, you know, whatever, you know, is the object of your meditation in front of you. You do certain mantras, you imagine that the white, you know, there's, you know, depending on which, you know, which Buddha or which practice you're doing, depending on different colored light and so forth and so on that enters into you, you do the purification, you know, and you gain all the merits, etc. And then the deity dissolves into you. So this is a standard boiler template way, you know, practice basically. And then each, you know, as you do each one of them, they slightly change this and that, you know. So it's important, as I said, when you're doing these meditations, to really imagine, you know, like how the Shakyamuni Buddha looks, or, you know, whoever the deity is, how he or she looks, you know, the love and compassion and so forth and so on, to make it, you know, really feeling it, right? That's what makes the change happen in our mind stream. Okay. So, So Don spoke last time about, the six guidelines in terms of each of the three jewels, right? You know, the Buddha jewel is, did anybody have any questions? He said that people might have questions about them. No? It's pretty clear. Okay. So today then, to finish, by the way, this refuge, I don't know why they do it the other way around, but it's good that this time around we're doing the refuge module before the spiritual teacher, because it actually, I think it works better in that sequence, right? Normally we do the spirit, because I normally do the, you know, lead the spiritual teacher one, and somebody else has the refuge, but this time around we kind of switched. Because, you know, this is the same, you know, if you hold somebody as your guru, as your spiritual teacher, you know, it's the same refuge that you are going to go to him or her, right? So it's important to know what that means. Right. In the Lam Rim, they do the spiritual teacher first, because I think, you know, for Tibetans and Indians back then and even now, having a guru is not a big deal, right? So that they started with that, right? But for Westerners, I think it makes more sense to do the refuge first and then do the spiritual teacher, you know. But anyway, that's a different thing. So today we'll talk about the benefits of going for refuge. That's one thing. And then the second thing is, you know, there's some advice given on what to do and what not to do, you know, when you take refuge, right? So I'm going to do the benefits first because it's on the exam. So, you know, I better do it. So if I run out of time, it's okay, because at least I got the one that the questions, you know, the one that asked the question. Anyway, okay. So, there's eight benefits. And, you know, it's important to understand the benefits, because you want to, you know, again, Buddhism is a very rational tradition, right? So it kind of always, you know, they tell you what the benefits are, they tell you what the disadvantages of not doing whatever it is, you know, not taking refuge are, and then they tell you the qualities, you know, of refuge and so forth and so on, and then they tell you, here's how you take a refuge, you know, so that's how they always go, right? Same with karma, same with, you know, spiritual teacher, et cetera, et cetera. So the benefit says, the first benefit is that by taking refuge, generating faith in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, we become an inner being, right? So what that means is that we basically generate confidence and faith in ourselves that, you know, that we can make the change, right? That we can purify the negative imprints that are in our mind stream, that we can create the merit to continue to make progress, right? That, you know, we are the ones who have control over how, you know, of what the future holds in a way, right? We think that we don't have control just because we have a relatively myopic view, but we actually are the ones who have control. That's what the Buddha said. Because the Buddhas or the teachers can't make it happen for us, right? I mean, the Buddhas can teach us, the Buddhas can guide us, the Buddhas can appear in front of us and tell us, you know, here's my suggestion. But finally, at the end of the day, we're the ones who have to take the medicine, right? So if we don't take the medicine, then it's not going to happen. So like that, we are the ones in control. So that's what it kind of means as an inner being, right? So we take kind of, in a way, you know, we're taking responsibility for our actions and, you know, and whatever, you know, good things happen, we're also the ones responsible for it, right? And we stop thinking, well, and the opposite, of course, is, you know, instead of an inner being, you could be an outer being. An outer being means that, you know, you put faith in external things, right? You know, new girlfriend or new car or bigger house or blah, 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 right? So because, you know, that's what how we are normally, right? How we most of us are, maybe all of us are. So that's the first benefit, right? Of that we become an inner being. So the other great benefit is that, you know, it subdues our disturbing thoughts, right? And this is really important because that's how we stop creating, you know, negative karma, right? So, you know, it's clear, right? Subduing our mind means that, you know, we are less susceptible to, you know, the constant barrage of external temptations and attachments and all that stuff that arise, right? And because of which we act. Instead, you know, if we take vows or take refuge, you know, they're very helpful in subduing the mind, right? Because you're always watchful. You know, if you take vows, for example, you know, you're very mindful about what you're doing, right? That's one of the great things about taking vows, right? You know, it really makes you question every action, and that's really wonderful, you know. And the other benefit, by the way, of this is not, you know, just as an aside, of taking vows is that, you know, when the day, like, we took, you know, you guys took precepts. Did you take precepts on Friday? Yeah, take refuge. You have taken precepts. So, you know, you are living in the vow for that day, right? So all your actions become, even the neutral actions become positive, right? Because the neutral action, normally our actions, the neutral actions specifically, are done without any intention, right? Right? They just happen, right? I'm just, you know, I'm walking from here to there because I need to get a cup of coffee. That's a neutral action. Right, has no positive karma or negative karma. But if you're living in the vow, then everything becomes intentional. Right? That's what they say, right? Because there is an underlying intent always, at all times. Rinpoche said, even when you're sleeping, you're gathering merit. So, because, just because you're in the vow, right? So, you know, those of you who've taken refuge, and, you know, if you want to continue on the path, then, I encourage you to take at least the lay vows, right? They're not hard. I mean, you know, I think I spoke about them last or a couple of times ago, right? I mean, no lying, no stealing, no killing. Lying, stealing, killing. Those things are easy. I'm pretty sure nobody in this room does those things. You know, maybe lie, white lie once in a while, but other than that, I'm pretty sure none of us. So those are easy. No sexual misconduct. That's relatively easy, right? Sexual conduct is okay, but no misconduct, right? Like, you know, where you having an affair with, you know, I mean, where, you know, you might be breaking someone's trust and so forth and so on, right? Or coming in between, you know, a couple, etc. So that's also relatively easy. Then there's no intoxicants, right? Which means no alcohol, no drugs, of course. And I think no cigarettes, but I'm not sure about that. I think they also include cigarettes. Coffee's okay, even though it's addictive. So maybe that's the hardest one. I don't know, but I haven't missed it, you know, in the 15 years that I've had these vows, right? So, but I encourage you to consider it because it, remember all of our actions have, you know, all the practices that we do, all the visual, you know, the practice that we did, all the, you know, the refuge prayers we do, all the ritual, like the green Tara practice or the Guru Puja, you know, all the stuff that the center does. It's all to collect merit and purify negative karma. That's really what it is, right? Because without that, we can't make progress. Right? I mean, those two things we have to do is, you know, create the seeds for future happiness or future, at least future human life so that we can continue to study the Dharma and we can be born at a time the Buddha and the Dharma are around, right? So can continue to make progress. So that's, we have to create the merit for those things. And then we have to purify the negative karma so that we remove the obstacles in our way, right? Because, you know, we are going to face obstacles on the path. And so the more negative karma you can remove, the better, easier it's going to be, the faster you're going to get there, right? So that's all of the practices, that's the goal. I mean, you know, they're all underlying it all. So, so the vows, you know, is basically about creating the merit, right? That's why living in the vows, taking precepts are so meritorious. I have to admit that on Friday I totally spaced out and I forgot it was Sakadawa till later after dawn, so I didn't get to take precepts, so there you go. Anyway, okay. Sakadawa was Friday. That's the day of, you know, the combined day of Buddha's birth, death, and enlightenment, all in one day. So it's a very auspicious day. There's like two other days like that in the Buddhist calendar. Okay. So we talked about vows. And of course, you know, if you take bodhisattva vows, you know, the higher level, you know, the lay vows are of course important, they're foundational, but then you might have bodhisattva vows, like, you know, if you're, you know, when Rinpoche comes and he gives a, you know, Tenrezig initiation or something, I think there's a bodhisattva vows in there, right? If you take the bodhisattva vows, they're higher level vows, right? And so you have to be careful in making sure that you keep those, right? And finally, if you get higher tantric vows, then those are extremely important to keep, right? Because those have, breaking tantric vows is very, that I'm sure someone will, Robbie will, or no, Don will talk about in the last module in the tantra class. But, so those vows are very, if you're getting initiations or something, you must keep those vows, whatever vows are required for that, by the teacher, by the master, and for that practice. So, but the good news is that we're all human beings, so we do break those vows. So you can purify that again and retake the vows, right? So it's not like all is lost. Okay. The third benefit is that it reduces mental afflictions and purifies negative karma. Right? Reduces mental afflictions and purifies negative karma. It's simply because we have decided to do virtuous things. We've decided that when we take refuge, that we will not follow the negative mind, right? Which is completely opposite to the, to our normal way of, where we mindlessly are just, doing this, mindlessly, under attachment or aversion, we are taking all these actions, right? Without thinking about the cause and the result and so forth and so on. So, and as soon as we take refuge, the negative imprints in our minds, they begin to be purified, right? So, the reason is that, when you take refuge, at least the way it was explained to me, was that when you take refuge, you are essentially putting yourself in the hands of the Buddhas, right? The hands of the enlightened ones. And also, if you do it with a teacher, then your teacher, right? First of all, that brings great blessings, right? The pleasing the Buddhas is, they say that, one of the greatest things one can do, and that's why you'll learn next time in the spiritual teacher module, it says that, there's three ways or four ways of pleasing your teacher, and the most important, like you can give gifts and you can spread his good name and so forth and so on, but the most important one for a qualified teacher is that, you practice his instruction, you put his instructions into practice, right? Because that pleases the teacher, right? That's the best way one can give a gift to a teacher, I guess. So pleasing your teacher, the pleasing the Buddhas, and you'll learn next time, in the next module, why the teacher is equivalent to a guru, but anyway, teacher is equivalent to the Buddhas. So pleasing the Buddhas and the Gurus is extremely meritorious, right? Because we gain their blessings. And, the blessings are another way of increasing our merit, purifying our obstacles, purifying our negative karma, and also makes us more humble. That's what I think from a more practical level, right? It just, putting yourself in the hands of a guru or the Buddhas, makes you more humble, right? That, we don't know everything. What you're saying is, I don't know everything, please help me, right?
So, because we tend to think we know everything, right? I mean, the fourth benefit is that we are able to easily create a great amount of merit or positive potential in our mind. So the previous one was where we could, you know, we could purify negative karma. This one is about taking refuge, also creates great amount of merit, right? So because, you know, because when we have when we take refuge, remember, we become an inner being, right? You know, and that means that we have more confidence in ourselves, right? That we are going to do the right thing, that we're on the right path, that we're going to do the right thing, right? And so the more confidence we have in us and in the teachings, the easier it becomes to do virtuous things, right? So that's why it's not a catalyst, but it's a, I guess, fuel, you know, for creating for, you know, more merit. Yeah, that's pretty much all I have really about that. It's pretty obvious, I think. And of course, as I talked about, you know, you gain the blessings and so forth and so on. The blessings, of course, purify as well as create merit, right? So that's part of it. So the next fifth benefit is that it protects us from becoming overwhelmed by negative forces or influences. So, protects us from being overwhelmed by negative force or influence. What does that mean? So, so when we take refuge, and you know, we have veneration for the teachings, and you know, and we study the teachings, we understand cause and effect, right? So we realize that the obstacles, the suffering we have right now, is a result of some cause, some seed having ripened, right? Some negative imprint having ripened. So instead of blaming others, we basically can say, you know, this is not out of the blue, it's really my creation. Right? So we can take responsibility, if you will. A lot of times we tend to think, oh, gee, so-and-so is doing all this to us, right? We're the victim in a way, right? And it's kind of nice, you know, you get this self-righteous feeling, right, of being a victim. But, but it doesn't help the suffering. It doesn't help it go away, right? But if we have... You know, and this is difficult to generate. I mean, I certainly haven't yet. But the more we take refuge, the more we have faith in the teachings, the more, you know, more we understand, the better we understand karma and so forth and so on, and the easier it becomes to, you know, so when obstacles arise, it's easier to just kind of let them just go by, right? Without being too affected by them, right? Because you can say, well, you know, this is life. I mean, that's what I, you know, why would I expect it to be different, right? I mean, we expect every day to just go absolutely smoothly, right? I mean, that's what we think. I mean, today I wake up, I think everything's going to go absolutely hunky-dory. And then when something happens, we get irritated, right? I mean, I don't know why we have that expectation. I mean, we should have learned by now, right? But if you have the understanding of the karmic cause and effect, then you kind of say, well, okay, you know, it's another negative imprint coming up. It makes it easier to kind of, you know, get past the obstacles.
Right. So it becomes, protects us from becoming overwhelmed by negative forces or influences, right? Because sometimes, you know, if you're able to do that, then, you know, you're able to avoid things like depression. You're able to avoid things like, great anger, you know, all that stuff that we suffer, and, you know, that we struggle with, right? All of us have those struggles. So that's what it means by negative forces and influences, right? Again, it keeps our mind subdued, right? That was one of the benefits, right? To subdue our minds, right? So this is kind of like that. So the sixth benefit is that we don't fall to the lower realms that, the sixth benefit is that we don't fall into the lower realms. And that's all it says. So that must be obvious. Well, I mean, it makes sense again, right? I mean, the stronger your refuge, the more your faith in the teachings, the more virtuous things you're going to do and fewer non-virtuous things you're going to do, so the more causes you're going to create to fall into the lower realms. Right? I mean, that's pretty, it's a kind of a sequence of, you know, deductions, I guess. Okay, so the seventh benefit is that we accomplish every temporary and long-term goal from taking refuge. And that's because, you know, temporary and long-term goals. So temporary goals obviously are goals of this life, right? Those are the temporary goals. And the long-term goals, of course, our ultimate goal of reaching enlightenment and so forth and so on, but even less than that is at least to gain a human life the next time, right? That's like the minimum required condition that has to be there, right, is to gain a human life, right? So the only way we can do that is through practice. And if we don't take refuge, we're not going to practice. Right? So practice here doesn't mean just practicing on the cushion, of course, right? This means practicing what the teachings say, right? Or what the instructions are from your teacher. So the more refuge we have, the more practice, and therefore the more success, right? And the greater the likelihood of having human lives, right? So that we can continue on the same path. And the final benefit, we quickly realize enlightenment. That's basically the byproduct of the other seven, right? So the more we practice, the sooner we get to enlightenment, right? And of course, you know, enlightenment here, it doesn't mean just enlightenment for ourselves, right? This enlightenment means enlightenment that includes all others, right? The ultimate compassion. So those are the eight benefits of taking refuge. And it's important, actually, if you're taking refuge, to meditate on those eight benefits. And I think there's somebody showed me, right? There's a meditation already in the syllabus, or in the... Not Dawn. It was... Oh, is it a handout from Dawn? Okay. All right. Very good. So those are the eight benefits, right, of taking refuge. So it's important to really understand those, right? So, you know, if you are doing a Lamrim retreat, right, and you're in the refuge section, so you spend a long time thinking about those eight benefits, because, you know, you have to convince yourself, that is what we need to do, and right, you have to internalize it. So that meditation actually is quite important. Any questions? I've rattled on for a long time.
So what is the difference between the benefits of taking refuge and taking vows? Or is it, I thought the vows was more quickly achieve realizations.
Well, I mean,
which is kind of the last thing on this list.
Right. So, well, I mean, so in some ways they have a lot of overlap, right? The vows are mainly to purify obstacles and create positive merit, right? That's basically what the vows are about, right? So that you refrain from non-virtuous actions and you perform, actually it's mainly refraining from non-virtuous actions, you know, right? And the refuge, you know, so the vows are, you know, vows, you know, vows are to basically stop committing any further creating further negative karma, right? Refuge is much bigger, right? I mean, you're basically supplicating to the Buddhas, right? You're asking for their blessings, you're putting yourself in their hands, and you are following, you know, you're generating great faith in the teachings and so forth and so on, right? So all that, of course, creates merit and also purifies obstacles, like it's, you know, one of the benefits, right? But it's much broader and much more and all-encompassing.
And one of the things I was reading, I want to make sure I interpreted this right, is the idea that once you took vows and you made that commitment, that now it was intentional every minute that you were living according to the vows and not just doing it because you thought it was a good idea.
Right.
And because it's intentional, you're living up to something you said you were going to do, that you vowed
right.
you were going to do,
mm-hmm.
that you're gathering merit minute by minute.
That's right.
Even when you're sleeping.
Yeah.
So
that's exactly
okay.
right. I think you expressed it better than I did, but yeah, that's exactly right, how it
okay.
works.
I have a question about the achieving your goals.
Long-term goals, temporary
right,
and long-term goals.
So that is spiritual goals. That's
mm-hmm.
the question I had before, and you kind of like described it in those terms. So I wanted to make sure, because when
yeah,
you
yeah,
read
are,
it, it seems like
yeah,
oh,
yeah, no,
I want to.
These are spiritual goals.
Yeah.
No, I didn't mean to say these are like, you know, may I have a cuter girlfriend? You know, no.
Right.
These are spiritual goals, whether in this life or in future lives, and of course, finally, enlightenment.
Cool.
Right? So, that's all I was going to say. Like, for example, I'll give you an example. I have, my teacher has given me, like, certain things to accomplish in this lifetime, right? So I went to, like, a few years ago, Geshe-la's teacher, Kenpo Rinpoche, right? He was here. And I went up to him and asked him, okay, you know, I have these, you know, I told him the goals. And I said, what can I do to be able to attain those goals, right? And he said that whenever you're doing anything, offer it to the Buddhas, right? Like especially like food offering and so forth and so on. Those are easy to do, right? So, and how is this related to refuge? It's because that only works if you have refuge, right? So so that's how kind of refuge helps with your, you know, I have, those are spiritual goals in this lifetime, right, that I have. And of course I have some, you know, hopefully, they're going to lead to spiritual goals in future lifetimes, right? But at least this lifetime, he said, here's what you do, right? And of course that requires refuge. Probably a stronger refuge than I have, unfortunately. Anyway.
Any other questions on benefits? Okay.
I only have 15 minutes, so I'll fly through. The only other thing I wanted to talk about. Oh, okay. Well, I won't. I'll try to finish by 8:30. So there's six kind of advice, six pieces of advice that they give when you take refuge, after you've taken refuge, right? So it says, for the first one, it says, always remember the qualities of the three jewels, right? So you can, you know, it's, you know, the qualities of the Buddha, you know, the quality of the Buddha's body and mind, and, you know, that we talked about, the qualities of the Dharma, why they're, you know, worthy of refuge, the qualities of the Sangha, so forth and so on, right? So it's all, it's important to kind of, the advice is to think about them at least daily, you know, like when you're doing your practice in the morning or in the evening or whatever, pick a time. And you just kind of do it, you know, just to think about them, right? Because it kind of strengthens, kind of reminds you, for one thing, right, what those are and why it's, you know, why you're doing this, right? So that's one thing. So you take refuge three times in the morning and three times at night, right? So that's kind of just standard operating procedure anyway. You know, you do, you know, you bookend your practice, you know, you do a practice in the morning and you do your purification at night. You know, those are kind of the two bookends of the day. And so you can do it during those times. Whenever you eat or drink something, first offer it to the Triple Gem. Right? So this has, you know, great benefit, because, you know, not only are you, you know, thinking about them, you're, and I'll tell you a little bit about, you know, there's a visualization, but not only are you thinking about them and, you know, and strengthening your refuge, but also, you are, you know, this is a very meritorious act, right, to make an offering to the Buddhas, right? And, you know, those of us who have spiritual teachers, you know, as in the next module, for example, maybe Don will talk about it. I don't know if he will or not, because he's trying to smash it all in three classes, but cram it all in three classes. But normally those of us who have spiritual teachers, we offer it to our teacher first, right? So, you know, so you imagine the food or the drink you have is like nectar, right? It's not just food, right? Because it's, the Buddhas don't need food, right? It's a transcendental offering, if you will, right? So you imagine it's nectar and the guru resides in your heart, for example, and you take the first bite and you offer it to the guru or the Buddha in our hearts, right? So that's, and usually in the beginning, of course, you do the fruit offering prayer, which if you look it up in the book, you'll see it's not very long. So you do the fruit offering prayer, you do that visualization, you offer it to the Buddhas or your gurus. And then you eat, right? So that's the third piece of advice that they give. Always rely on the Triple Gem. So when something goes well, rely on the Triple Gem. When something goes wrong, rely on the Triple Gem. Don't find some other main refuge, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. So, yeah, so, you know, think about, you know, so, you know, when times are good, we don't think about refuge, right? That's the problem in the God realms, right? They don't even think about any of this stuff because time, it's always so good, right? So when times are good for us, we don't think about refuge. When times are bad, we also don't think about refuge, right? Because, you know, we're trying to avoid it at all costs, you know, trying to push it away at all costs with lots of, lots of things that, you know, but we don't think about how, you know, taking refuge in the Buddhas, you know, helping them guide us, right, gaining, you know, getting their blessings, you know, of the gurus and of the Buddhas, so that we can use that time, you know, time of those obstacles as an opportunity, right, to practice. So I'm just as guilty as the next person, right? So I'm not saying I'm, you know, I think about all these things, you know, suddenly refuge comes to me when things aren't going well, but I try to remember, you know, I mean, once in a while I think about, you know, what would Lama Zopa Rinpoche say right at this moment, right? I mean, that's when I'm, you know, so that's a good, you know, or like, you know, those billboards, what would Jesus do, right? So I think about like that. What would Rinpoche do, right? So, of course, the first thing is compassion. That's the first thing he will say. And the second thing he will talk about, you know, emptiness and so forth and so on. So that all goes through my head, right? And it's a great, it's really nice, you know, it really helps with at least the small irritations. You know, we are human beings. The big things, it's hard to overcome them, right? Because we haven't practiced enough, we haven't gained enough merit, we haven't purified enough obstacles. It's hard for us to not get depressed when one of the big things in life happens, right? But with our current practice, we can overcome the little irritations that happen throughout the day that get us in a bad mood, that make us do, you know, speak out of anger or, you know, harsh words and so forth and so on, right? Commit non-virtuous action. Even though we are human beings, we can overcome those bits at least, right? I mean, so we can continue to make progress, right? So, if, you know, for the big things in life, when I think about what would Rinpoche do and I think about compassion, emptiness, Can I say that it really helps me? I mean, at least it's creating an imprint in my mind stream, right, to think about those things. The more I do that, the more it's going to be habitual, right? So that someday I will be able to overcome those things through compassion and emptiness and so forth and so on, right? But the smaller things are much easier. You know, I can overcome those now because I've been thinking about what would Rinpoche do, right? So those don't get me anymore. Like, you know, my wife shouting from the top of the stairs, "Why did you do that again?" Right? And you know, the first thing is that you go into your defensive posture and you're gonna shout back about, "Oh, you remember the last time you did so and so?" Right? So, you know, when that arises, you think, "Oh, you know." So, you know, your mind is calmer. It's subdued, right? It brings that, subdues your mind. You realize that, you know, she's having a bad day probably, or maybe I realize that, well, I probably shouldn't have done that, right? She has a point. So like that, right? So it's easier to overcome those things and, you know, and makes things go smoother, right? So those we can actually make a change. Okay. Always rely on the triple gem, so we talked about that. Fifth one is, whenever possible and appropriate, encourage others to take refuge in the triple gem. Well, of course, this doesn't mean that, you know, you go and, you know, stand outside and start preaching about how Buddhism is great, you know. It really means, if it's appropriate, right? If you think that, you know, if that would help that person, then you can suggest it to them, you know. But they don't have to. Just make sure that you understand that they don't have to take your advice, and you don't feel that, you know, whatever. If, you know, if they don't take your advice, or, you know, or also, what can help is, like, if you, Anyway, that's okay. All right. So then finally, the sixth one is, having taken refuge, never give it up. Yeah. You know, it's to understand that, you know, why would we give it up? Because we would think, oh, gee, if you know, this clearly isn't working, right? So I'm not going to bother with this, right? Or, you know, I can't, you know, this can't, you know, karma doesn't make any sense. So this is just absolutely bogus. I'm just going to, you know, move on to other things, right? So, you know, one, instead of doing that, instead of just, you know, throwing the baby out with the bathwater, we can say, well, maybe it's not the teachings. Maybe it's just me, right? Maybe my mind isn't ready, right? That's one of the most important things. You know, Venerable Amy, you know, guys know Venerable Amy, right? It's because she has come a few times, right? So I met her in 1990, right after she became a nun. So that must have been 1999. Yeah. And I was taking the first Discovering Buddhism class, one of the first two Discovering Buddhism classes ever, you know, done, you know. We had these little mimeographed, I don't know if you remember, mimeographed copies of stuff, but anyway, we have mimeographed sheets and these really grainy videos and, you know, Lama Yeshe and so forth and so on. But anyway, so one of the things she said in one of these Discovering Buddhism classes was, she said, you know, if you find something that you can't accept, just say, well, you know, I'll just put that aside. I'll just see, you know, maybe I'll come back to it someday, right? Which is fine, right? If you can't handle karma, it doesn't make any sense, put it aside, right? There are lots of other things about compassion and generosity and refuge and so forth and so on that are valuable, right? And maybe, you know, then karma will make more sense. You know, so like that, it's important to not just give up refuge because something doesn't make sense or you think, you know, this can't be happening to in my life if this dharma were really true or whatever, you know. Yeah. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's all I had to say for today, actually. Anybody have any last questions that they would like to ask? Okay.
You said when you take refuge in your vows, your actions are greater, the merit you create is greater. What about your negative actions? Like, you know, if you stole something without refuge or vows,
it's also
okay.
Greater.
Okay. Okay,
right,
so it's a double-edged sword.
Yeah, well, absolutely. You're breaking your vow, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, so, I mean, yeah. So that's not good. But, again, as I said, all is not lost because you can do certain practices to purify having broken your vow and retake your vows, right? So you can get past that, right? And, you know, and all this works because of emptiness, right? Because there is no such thing, there is no such inherent sin, if you will, right? So because of that, because of the non-inherentness, it's empty of inherent existence, so it can be transformed, right, through purification. That's why purification works. Anyway, that's a deeper topic. Yeah. Okay. That's all I had. So I hope it was helpful, this class, and
please keep continue to, you know, to take the rest of the classes, and it'll, and some people take them multiple times, you know, so if it doesn't make sense the first time, it'll make sense the second time, if not the second time, it makes sense the third time, like that, right? So, yeah, okay. Well, thanks very much. See you later. Okay, page 36. We'll do the dedication prayers and the long life prayer for His Holiness and Lama Zopa. Okay. Due to the... Oh, sorry. Everybody have page 36? Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish but increase more and more. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All-powerful Chinrezig Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. You who uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjunath's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplished the magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. Okay. I am moving back after 11 years to California in a few months, a couple of months, to a retreat center called Vajrapani, which is one of the FPMT retreat centers that I've been a member of for 20 years now. And I'll be living there and working there as their co-SPC. So, yeah. So I will still be in the family. I'm not disappearing. And someday I'll be back. You know, I just don't know when. We will be back, my wife and I. Au revoir for now. Yeah, sorry? Absolutely. I mean, there are amazing, you know, so they have a Geshe-la, I requested and Geshe-la accepted 1 year. Every year around Thanksgiving, right after or right before Thanksgiving, I can't remember which, they have what's called Kopan West, right? You know Kopan Monastery where all this started, right? Lama Yeshen Lama Zopa used to teach Kopan Monastery in Nepal. So they have a 10-day or maybe a week or 10-day retreat every year on the Lamrim, right, called Kopan West. And so Geshe-la taught there 1 year, you know. I'm sure he'll be back because I asked him and he said he would like to come back. So that's a wonderful retreat, you know, if you're, if you want to do that, right? And there are lots of others. You can go to their website, but, because it was the first FPMT center in North America, you know, and that's Lama Yeshe started the center, and so it has an amazing energy to it. I mean, it's not like any other center that I've been to. So it's in the Redwood Forest, and it's hard to get to, but once you get there, it's wonderful. You know, it's borders, you know, state land that you can go up to the top of the mountain. It's a long hike, but you can get to the top of the mountain, and you can see the ocean and the Monterey Bay on a nice sunny day. So, they have a lot of land, and so, you know, it's very, well, they have a lot of land, but most of it is canyons, so you can't really build much. That's the problem. Anyway, see you soon. All right.